Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And my love, my dear rabbit, what is the topic today?
Well, every now and then we have to remind ourselves that our program is about drink as well as food.
Right.
So we sort of accumulate a few that fit into the drink category.
So we have another booze program.
And then we bring them to you. So we have another boozy program. But it's a very interesting program, going way back to the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, where we were back in the early part of the year, as you all remember if you're a regular listener to the program.
It was actually March, so it's not too
March.
Early.
Well, yeah. It was earlier in the year. Considerably earlier than August.
Yes.
And a group called the First Families of Wine.
Oh, yes.
That was formed just a few years ago to try to promote the quality end of Australian wines.
Right. I remember this.
And there are all kinds of restrictions as to who can belong and who can't.
Yes.
Bruce Tyrrell, who's the current head of the organization, has been associated with wine from the Hunter Valley of New South Wales, near Newcastle, where I used to live, almost from birth, and that's been quite a long time.
What generation is he? I can't remember. A lot of these were third or fourth generation.
He's like the third or fourth generation.
Right.
His father, Murray, used to travel to the United States. In fact, we met Murray Tyrrell in Pittsburgh on one occasion when he was here for the Pittsburgh Wine Festival. So they're a big name in Australian wines. And some of the other big names in Australian wines decided that they needed, as I say, to get together. And in the interview, which you're about to hear, Bruce explains why that is and a little bit more about the program. The lucky people who were there a couple of days before, including Ann and Peter, got to taste library wines from all the members of the
good stuff. First families
of wine at an absolutely wonderful wine tasting at the Hyatt Hotel in Melbourne. That and said she couldn't remember, but then all of a sudden she remembered what a lot of fun we had, and what a great effort it was on their part to serve these wines to sommeliers from around the world who were invited specially to come to Melbourne for the Food and Wine Festival. So here's Bruce.
This man sitting to my right might just about have served me wine in 1966 when I was first in Australia. And if you wanted a buzz on a Sunday, you took off from the city of Newcastle where I was living up the Hunter Valley and you went to Tyrrell's or Tulloch's winery and pretended you were interested in sampling some wine. Now, it's taken me a long time to catch up with the man who now runs his operation, Bruce Tyrrell. Bruce Tyrrell and Peter are in Melbourne, associated with the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival and the world's 50 best restaurants and all that kind of good stuff that's been going on. But there's something else really interesting that's going on, which in particular is what I wanted to talk to Bruce about, because it's an unusual cooperation of people who might otherwise compete. How about that for a good start?
Yeah, thanks. Interesting, the group, which is Australia's First Families of Wine, Ross Brown always describes it as coopetition. And I think it's a very good, it's a great way of putting it. We, as a group, we came together initially in 2006, and then it grew to we formally launched it in 2009. So the members are, I'll have to do this by state or I'll forget someone, the Bortleys, McWilliams and ourselves, New South Wales, Brown Brothers, Tabilt, which is the Purbrick family, and Campbell's from Victoria, the Birches from Howard Park in WA, and then South Australia, the Taylors and the Barrys from Clare, the Hill Smiths at Yolumba, the Henschke's from the Barossa area, and then the Osbornes from Darrenburg in McLaren Vale. And we really came together because in the mid-last decade, particularly the UK press, was all full of all Australian wines the same, it's all industrial, it's all average quality, and it's all in an English supermarket at £4 a bottle. And to some extent, we had a bit of a corporatisation in our industry here, and we were being represented by a lot of marketing executives in a three-piece suit and a pointy head and a laptop computer and a propeller on top of the pointy head. And we lost a bit of who we were. So as a group of the old families, we decided that it would be our job, it needed to be our job to fix that. As the custodians of the stories and the history and the future of the Australian wine industry. And so we came together, went to England the first year, and since then, particularly in the UK, we completely turned the opinion of Australia back to us. And I remember a journalist, the first function in London, young journalist, he said to me, "What holds this group together?" And I smiled at him and I said, "If you say Ross Brown's a dill, I'll pick you up to hit you the third time. And then I'll leave you lying in a little pile on the ground." And he said, "But he's your competitor." And I said, "Yes, but he's my oldest and dearest friend in the wine industry."
And not only that, his success contributes to your success. Because if he's got a bang-up wine that he's putting out there, people are going to think, chances are, Tyrrells must have something similar. Or Tobilk must have something similar. Or Howard Park must have something similar. And so it's going to take them back to Australian wines that they neglected in their buying habits, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. It certainly brought people's attention back to Australia, and particularly at the better end. And I suppose it opened up the realisation that, particularly amongst us, there is a future. There's a next generation coming through that we're all very proud of, and so that was the story of the future. And we actually know each other a lot better. We cooperate a lot more than we used to. Actually, I remember saying to all the younger generation, they're at our winery a couple of years ago, and we send them on tour every year as a group, so that they firstly do part of our work, but they get to know each other. And I said to them, "You've all got the same problems. You don't need to waste any money on consultants. Just talk to each other. But you all know, I know that you all think your dad won't retire, and you want him to. He won't let you have your own way completely. And you're all frightened that he's going to run off with a floozy and they'll spend all your inheritance." And there was other all shook their heads. And I said, "Keep talking to each other. Keep in contact. Keep that. Because you'll answer the questions for yourselves if you do that. And if you lot are all mates, then I know that our industry is in good hands."
Now, we were together just the other evening and we had a very special event where you opened up some wines that you'd been keeping for some appropriate special purpose, whatever it might be, and you used it to great effect. I know, because I listened to some of the sommeliers who were tasting these delicious nectars that are things that are not on the open market. But are they going to find their way to market? Is there a level of the quality that we sampled the other evening that you're going to be able to make available in world markets?
It's one of the changes in the last 20 years. Is 20 years ago, we were selling a lot of day-to-day good drinking wine. The last 10 years or more, currency changes, we really had to sell the better part of our production, which is there. The wines you saw the other night, we only actually found out that we had the ability to do that tasting 2 weeks before we did it. And so we'd done one of those masterclasses, so 12 wines, one from each of us, 5 years ago. 8 of those wines you had the other night were the same ones served 5 years ago. I added it up before we sat down, and without the Campbell's Musket, which is Solero, and even Cole Campbell's not quite sure how old it is. The Solero could be 50 plus years old. Mm-hmm. But if you added up the ages of all the other 11 wines, it's 155 years. It was pretty amazing tasting, and it was something I was very keen to do because they were going to have a lot of tastings, these young sommeliers, but they were going to have a lot of current release tastings. And I think it's very important to show your top wines with age, because at the end of the day, if a wine's pretty and it looks really cool and all of that stuff, but at 5 or 6 years old, it's gone, mm-hmm. then it's only a commercial, ordinary wine. It's got to have the ability to live.
Now, will you open up the group to more participants? I mean, there are some real up-and-coming wine districts like the Mornington Peninsula, where I've been absorbing massive quantities of Mornington Peninsula Pinot Noir since I've been here in Australia. And I've been in Tasmania before and sampled wines from Piper's Brook and other vineyards like that Andrew Peary created, where they're not the founding families, but they sure are making great wine.
No, we've got a strict set of rules. It has to be 100% family owned and operated. You have to have something in the Langton's classification. You have to be able to do a 20-year vertical. You've got to have two generations working in the business. You've got to be a member of the Winemakers Federation, which is the national body. And you've got to have a level of sustainable credentials. So it's not easy to get into. It's not that it's a private club just for us. It's not just a private club for those that are in it. It's you do have to meet those fairly stringent, mm-hmm. and also it's a group, and there are a couple who didn't, one who didn't come in the end got pushed away because the fellow would have destroyed it. One of those chaps that if he can't, he'd rather destroy something than give up his own way. Mm. So we've all become very much closer, and it works. It's not that it's a closed book. Somebody comes along, one of the older family companies that we all dearly wanted in there, wonderful people, but didn't have that high-end wine. Mm. And I remember the head of the family said, "Thank you. I'll be back in 10 or 15 years." And he said, "I needed this to make us improve the wine we're making."
And where was he from?
He was actually from South Australia. Old family business. Not hard to work out. And he said, I would have liked them in just on the brandy that they make. 90% of the cognac you buy wouldn't hold a candle to their wine. But it was table wine, and so we've got those set of rules, and we stick to them. And the other one that's probably most important, that Ross Brown, again, kept saying, we have to be able to do, as a group, a better job than if we did it individually.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over the states again, because people think of Australian wine as only South Australia. They've never heard of the Yarra Valley. They've never heard of the Hunter Valley in some cases. Let's just make sure our listeners know all the regions that are represented in your group.
Oh, within the group, there's 21 regions, and Australia has 61 separate grape growing regions. So we cover a fair chunk of them. There's about 1,400 years of business if you add them all up. There's 40. Well, this has been a moving feast because everyone's starting to have grandchildren. I think we're now up to 48 generations between the group, but that's changing. I know the Barry's about to have a grandchild in about 3 weeks' time, so everything's got to get reprinted again as they come. But that's the great part of it. And not only, you look at those wines we had on Monday night, there's some of the classic wines of Australia. Mm. But those wineries have also up to their eyeballs in In innovation, in research, in all of that, in all sorts of levels, in winemaking, in viticulture, in pure science, in the laboratories, through to computer networks in our offices. And we actually talk to each other about what we use and what doesn't work, that works, and what doesn't work, and which direction we're all going.
One last question, because everyone around the world knows about averages. They know about average temperatures. They know about average rainfall. What they don't know, unless they lived in Australia, is the average is a totally meaningless statistic, because in any given period, you might have 5 wet years in a row, then you might have 15 dry years right after that, then you might have 15 hot years right after that. That's got to be a challenge as a winemaker. Are you trying to do anything about sharing experience in that particular issue as well?
Certainly do. There's a quite a cross pollination of ideas between us all. I always have this conversation with Alistair Purbrick. He's carbon neutral, and I keep saying I'm not interested in carbon neutrality. Our aim is to reduce the amount of fossil fuel input per carton of wine that we make. And if I can do that, and we've done that in 7 years by 30%, then I'm actually really doing something. Mm. If I'm paying someone else to pollute on my behalf, then it doesn't count. Mm. So we have great arguments about that. Because sustainability is very much a part of it. And I think we're all coming to grips, trying to come to grips with the vast array and variety of science in the supposed in the climate change area. Mm-hmm. Every day I read something new. It's a bit like alcohol causes cancer. There's a different answer and a different bit of research released every day. So nobody knows where they stand. All I know is, as a farmer, is that the weather runs in cycles. I sat with my oldest grape grower at the end of 2014 vintage, and he said, you know, we've picked every block on exactly the same day as 1953. And so you hear from the academic and well-read inner city part of the population, that's actually never seen a piece of dirt, most of them, that climate change is a terrible thing and it's going to do all this. You come out to the farmers and we're quite so sure all this evidence that you're putting in front of us is consistent. The one thing I do know, having different properties in different parts of Australia, is that the climate is doing different things in each of those areas. And so, for instance, I work on, for us, the important temperatures, sort of 37, 38 degrees, because that's when vines shut down. So that's really important in the ripening period. This decade, we've had 10% of those days in the Hunter Valley, north of Sydney, that we've had down here at Heathcote, north of Melbourne, which is 800 k's south. Last decade, it was the other way around. So it happens in bits here and there, and as 2% of the world's output, I'm not sure too many changes in Australia are going to make that much difference. If we all do our little bit, it's a bit like the room we're sitting in has got every light turned on in it. We only need a quarter of the lights in this room on.
Well, that's a story for another day. Listeners, you got to find some time for a day. If you're in Sydney, you got to find some time for a day out. It'll take you 2.5 hours or so to get to the Hunter Valley and the community of Pocobin, which really doesn't exist. And you can meet this charming gentleman that I've so much enjoyed talking to, and a little bit of my personal history as I started out, and we were back in the Hunter Valley, I think, the last time in 2003. So we're obviously due to make a visit. We thank you so much for talking to us today, and we wish you well.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's great to talk to you this afternoon, and to everybody. Yeah, if you come to Australia, most people come into Sydney. We're only a couple of odd hours north, and there's always a cold bottle in the fridge somewhere to share with you.
for the rest of the program, we're going to be much closer to home, so don't go away, because after this break, we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, I am not, to be perfectly honest, a gin drinker, but as a result of this program, I've come to understand that there are many, many variations and quality levels and expressions of the spirit gin. And one of the more interesting of late is
going all the way back to the 17th century, by the way.
Okay.
But people are inventing new expressions of it. It seems like almost every day now.
Yes, and this is the case with it's called Terra Botanical Gin, and it's a collaboration between one of our favorite people, Lior Lev Sekars from La Boite in New York City, and Adam Quirk from Cardinal Spirits, and they work together. And here they are explaining how this whole thing evolved, and I love this gin.
And I'm still not entirely understanding why they produce it in Indiana, but I'm glad they do.
Oh, right. I've been exploring gin, and I think I'm becoming a really big fan, particularly the kind of herbal, botanical taste gin that you two developed. Now, you two are an old acquaintance, Lior Lev Sekars, who's a very famous chef who runs La Boite. And you'll have to tell us, Lior, what La Boite does. And Adam Quirk, who is from Cardinal Spirits, who actually produced this wonderful beverage called Terra Botanical Gin. Let's start with, to understand this a little bit, Lior, I told you earlier that in my eyes, you're a magician. You get flavors out of herbal and spice blends that I didn't even think were possible. Tell us about La Boite.
La Boite started about 11 years ago, after I cooked a bit all over the world for more than 20 years and realized how little people knew about spices, both in restaurants and at homes, and wanted to change things and show people, again, professionals and home cooks alike, how wonderful this idea of cooking and baking with spices could be, and let alone creating beverages.
Right. And we interviewed you a long time ago when you had a very important cookbook that came out, which I thought was ingenious because you would call for a particular number identifying one of your spice blends in the recipe, but no recipe for the spice blend, so they would have to buy it from you, right?
So book number one was indeed about our spice blends.
Yeah.
But book number two that came out last year, is dedicated to 102 single spices, and we do give for each and every one of those a recipe on how to make spice blends at home.
See, I didn't get that one. Maybe you could have your publicist send me a copy.
We'll take care of that.
Great.
Well, now,
no, Adam.
This is all very well, but I just want to get to the point where I understand how you managed to find someone who makes gin in Bloomington, Indiana. It seems like
actually,
it's a freakish happening.
I mean, Adam will tell you in a second, but okay. Adam, about 3 or 4 years ago, came here and we had a great conversation. Back then, Cardinal was in barely existing or just as a thought. And we agreed that when things were up and running, we will reconnect again. And I think what it is amazing about what Adam and the team at Cardinal do is really rethinking the whole idea of distilling and spirits and breaking it down to each and every ingredient and rethinking about sourcing the best possible ingredient for every spirit that is being distilled And when you think about that, spices all of a sudden come about, and that's how we connected, about this idea of sourcing the best possible spices and then also playing around and getting a bit more creative and trying to tell a great story through this terrigen.
Okay, now the Adam you're talking about is Adam Quirk, and he's the spokesperson for Cardinal Spirits. Are you the founder of Cardinal Spirits, Adam?
Yeah, I'm a co-founder.
Okay.
I have three other partners, and my role here is I am in charge of the development of new products as well as the branding and marketing and all the stuff that goes along with that.
And how did you end up doing this? You're in Bloomington, Indiana, which I know because I lived and worked in Indianapolis for a number of years, but it's a university town, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. In fact, about half of our population disappears every summer because the Indiana University has about 40,000 students, and the population of Bloomington is about 85,000. So, right at this time of year, it's kind of nice. You can park anywhere and get seats at any restaurant. But then, in about 3 weeks, the students return and the town fills up. And with that comes, a bunch of incredibly talented and curious kids who want to experience new things. So, that was definitely one of the impetus for building a distillery here was harnessing that sort of energy of the university town.
Had there been a distillery there before you started one? Indiana doesn't seem like the home of spirits in general in the United States.
Well, so a couple of fun points there. There were no distilleries in Bloomington as far as we could tell, and we actually went back as far as we could in the historical records and asked librarians to do some research for us. And there was one in an adjoining county, but surprisingly, there were actually a handful of large distilleries in Indiana for some time. It's kind of the Corn Belt here. A ton of corn, and that's the main ingredient in bourbon. There's still one huge distillery in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, over there by Cincinnati.
I know it. Yeah.
Yeah, it used to be Seagram's, and then it was called Lawrenceburg Distilling something or other, and now it was bought by a company called MGP, and they produce most of the rye whiskey consumed in this country, actually, and a good amount of the bourbon. In fact, a lot of the bourbon brands that are on the shelf today are actually made here in Indiana. They're just marketed as different things like Bullet Bourbon and Templeton and all these other sort of brands are actually made here at this one big distillery.
Well, does Cardinal Spirits make other spirits as well besides this gin that we're talking about?
We do. We make, in fact, I think we're up to 12 different products right now.
Mm.
And so with everything from vodka, we have a black raspberry-infused vodka. We actually have another style of gin that's more juniper-forward. And then we have two styles of rum. We have bourbon. We have single malt whiskey. We've got all sorts of fun stuff. And what we usually do is we release these products at the distillery first because we have a tasting room and a cocktail bar, and we can sell bottles. And we release them here, we see how they do, and if they do well, we send them out into distribution into, Indiana and Kentucky, and, now we're in six states, including New York.
Now, there's something about this gin that's really special. And I
love it, and I'm not even a gin drinker.
I can't put my finger on what it is. Several years ago now, I guess, time flies, so when you're having fun, we interviewed five or six different makers of, if you like, modern, updated British dry gin, which in and of themselves were very interesting. But you've got something really special. Is that because of Boat and their ideas, or is it your own ideas?
Yeah, it's definitely Lior. It was a pretty amazing process to go through. It started off, like Lior said, a few years ago. I visited a spice shop after just emailing him out of the blue, I had read an article about his art of blending in the New York Times, and I popped into his shop, and he invited me in, and we had a conversation, and at the time, Cardinal Spirits was just a twinkle in my eye, and we were still a year and a half away from opening. And I, you know, I just asked him once we're up and running, would you like to collaborate? And he said, yeah, let's do it. Email me. And it took a little bit longer than I hoped, but last year, I guess it was last spring or so, I reached out to him, and we started going through this process of developing this gin. And it was really just a couple of phone conversations about what the sort of feelings that we wanted this spirit to evoke, and sort of conceptually what we wanted it to be. We didn't discuss too much about the flavor profile. It was more, I guess, a little bit of a higher theoretical talk about what gin was, what it is now, and what it could become. And then he sent me a spice blend a couple weeks later after he worked out some ideas. We distilled that on our testing still, which is just a tiny little 7-gallon copper pot, and sent him some samples back. We tasted it. We had a couple little minor tweaks that we wanted to do just to, you know, adjust some of the flavors up and down. And he agreed, and he sent us the second batch, and it was really just, that was it. It was, the second batch was perfect. We distilled it. We passed it around the distillery, and I knew it was good because our production manager, his name is Jason Hackett, and he has an incredibly, he's just very honest, and he doesn't like too many things. So he tasted the gin, and he said, this is a good gin. And I knew that was like, from him, that was like, you know.
High praise, right? That's high praise.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really funny. There's one of the ones we interviewed about in London is, I can't remember whether it's Lawson's or something like that, but it's number 8. And we asked them why number 8, and they said, because it took us 8 tries to get it right.
Well, now, Leor described the taste he was going after as wilderness in a bottle. Tell us about that, Leor.
I think one of the fun thing about this collaboration is that, you know, I could say that both Adam and myself aren't, you know, a third generation of distillers or something like that. We come from a very culinary angle. It's appreciating product for their taste and their scent, and just wanting to make something that's super tasty. And I wouldn't say ignoring the tradition, because we both like respect it, but kind of writing our own new way of doing gin, perhaps. And I started reading a little bit about gin and tasted a few to the point that I just stopped, because I didn't want to be influenced by anything that was existing. All I wanted is to hopefully deliver the best possible blend so that the team at Cardinal could take over. The thing that we both did share is the love for, you know, the outdoors, the wilderness, this, you know, walking through, you know, a forest or a field and getting all of these amazing scents of wild herbs and flowers and plants. And can we capture that in a bottle? Maybe contrary to a lot of other, you know, gins that are out there that are very juniper forward.
Yeah,
which are
that's
great,
all I knew about.
Which are great, but, you know, we were hoping to do something, and I think both of us, again, agreed that we really wanted to do a gin that you could just enjoy as is and not just have to mix it with other elements to create a cocktail, which, again, is a great thing, but I think that like in food, each and every component has to taste really good on its own without the need to add anything to it. Obviously, you can add things and it makes it different and unique, but we wanted to perhaps do something like a sipping gin and change this perspective of gin that's consumed usually as part of a cocktail. So that was very helpful, you know, and I think the beauty of it is that, you know, we grew in different areas around the world. I'm from Israel, Adam's from Indiana, and so definitely different landscape, but at the end of the day, there's this similarity of, again, being outdoors and smelling what's happening and capturing those natural essence into a bottle.
Well, Daniel Boulou likes it a lot, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Yes, he features it.
And again,
it.
That's, I think, but when Danielle was here and we were, Adam was here also, and we were featuring the product, and, you know, it was a true testimony that we are perhaps onto something, you know, and even people who are, you know, heavy gin drinkers and connoisseur who at first said, well, this is not what I usually drink, once they put that aside, really love it because it's something different.
Well, you're succeeding because you're winning all kinds of major awards, aren't you?
We've won a few, yeah. We've actually had, I would say, more recognition and awards for this product than anything we've done in the past. We won the gold medal best in category at the American Distilling Institute tasting this year, which is
big deal.
One of the two biggest ones in the country. That was pretty exciting. And we were in the New York Times last month, and then the Wall Street Journal on this Saturday published a pretty large article about the gin, and it's been very well received.
Well, there's one question that is left now, is how does anybody get it? It's very special. I mean, we will say it is very special.
Yeah, it's distributed in, I believe, 5 states. So Indiana, Illinois, which is actually just mostly Chicago for us, Nashville, Tennessee, Kentucky, and New York. And actually, if you're listening from a place that's not in one of those areas, there's a website in New York called Mash and Grape that you can go to and order it, and they'll ship it to you.
Okay, so it's not your general website. It's a special website, Mash and Grape. Is spelled out?
It is, yeah. MASHANDGRAPE. And I believe it's just .com. The weird thing about, I mean, alcohol laws are weird everywhere, but in Indiana, we're not allowed to ship directly to a customer from our distillery, so we have to send it to a distributor, and then they send it to a retailer, and that retailer can then send directly to a customer.
Right. No, nobody's laws on liquor are more arcane than Pennsylvania's, I can tell you.
Here's a project for you. Are you familiar with the term Dutch courage, and do you know where it came from?
I'm familiar with the term, and no, I don't know where it came from.
It came from Holland with William of Orange, when he came over to marry Mary II of England, and they ruled the country together in the 1600s. And the secret to success of William of Orange's army was they got a tot of gin every day. and it was called Dutch Courage.
I remember that now, yeah.
Now you remember that. So you might have to make a special gin in honor of Prince William of Orange, otherwise known as William III of England.
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I can just see it, the title, Dutch Courage, on the bottle.
And when you do that, send us a bottle so we can make sure it's okay.
Thank you
both so much for joining us.
Again, the product is Terra Botanical Gin, and the way to get it is through Mash and spelled out grape.com. And both of you, you did a yeoman's job there. And you're going to have to tell me where that saying came from. It's a joke. I mean, I don't really want to know. But thank you for talking to us, Adam.
Thank you.
And Lior.
Thank you.
Yeah, and congratulations on a really fine product.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
One of the ways that people who start new distilleries, whatever you like to call them, to make gin or to make other potable beverages of an alcoholic nature, one of the things they can do is they can enter them in a big competition. There is a big-time competition. In fact, we've actually had the guy who heads up the competition on the program. Is it Dale DeBroff?
Oh, yes.
I think actually he's in charge of all the judges for the San Francisco World Spirits Competition, which allows people who distill around the world to show their wares, but it's particularly important for U.S.-based distilleries to do the same. So when Catoctin Creek Distilling Company won a double gold at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition, it caught our attention.
Yeah, we're right on that one.
and they caught ours. And what they make, they don't make gin, they don't make wine, they make rye whiskey.
Which is one of your favorite things.
Which is one of my favorite things. And they've been making it in Virginia, it turns out, for a very long time. Something that we didn't know. And we were pleased to find out. And we enjoyed it, and we hope they'll send us some more. So here is the, let's see, what's Scott from Catoctin Creek Distilling Company, and I can't find his last name. His last name must be on that sheet somewhere, but I don't know where it is. Never mind. His first name's Scott. It's the important thing. You'll find his last name as soon as the interview starts. So here we go.
We're going to be talking to Scott Harris of the Catoctin Creek Distilling Company, which came to our attention because it won a double gold award, a medal, at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition. Now, that's pretty good, Scott, right?
Yeah, I guess it's pretty good.
And what was the product that, what booze won it?
So that's our Roundstone Rye cask proof variant. We have different versions of the Roundstone Rye, our flagship spirit, and the double gold was particularly given to the cask proof, which is released at about 58% to 60% alcohol.
It's a good idea to be sitting down when you sip it.
Yes. As my wife tells me, I need to respect the juice when I drink it. So
I see.
Good. Well, one of the reasons, one of the things that caught our attention is that we know Virginia makes quite good wines. We spent several weeks there doing a program for Virginia Wine Month, which is, I think, in September every year, and we were there a little bit earlier than that. So we got around to quite a few places. But nobody ever offered us a spirit that was made in Virginia, and we didn't even know that happened. So
yeah,
perhaps you can explain why and how that took place.
It's really so wonderful that it is happening here. We first started our company in 2009. There were probably about six craft producers on a small level here in Virginia. And today, 2017, there's over 50. So it's definitely
wow.
growing and taking off. The interesting thing, though, is that Virginia is actually the birthplace of American spirits. So what's amazing is that pre-Revolutionary War, you know, everybody in America was a Brit, and we were all drinking lots and lots of rum. You know, sugarcane from the islands was brought up and distilled, and rum was not just for, you know, enjoyment, but it was necessity. You know, the water wasn't safe to drink, so you drink things like punches and beer and cider, and then it was used for tinctures and medicines and things. So, but when we had that nasty little skirmish with the Brits in 1776, the Brits got kind of pissed off at us and took away the supply of sugar, and so we had to really turn inward for our resources for spirits. And what we had in the country at the time was lots and lots of Scots-Irish immigrants and lots of land. And so with all that land, the Scots-Irish certainly know what to do with that. They plant the native grain which was rye. Not corn. Bourbon comes much later, but it was rye. So in Virginia, in Pennsylvania, in Maryland, on up into New York, and even Canada, rye was the predominant grain, and they were starting to make that into whiskey. Although it wouldn't be like whiskey we see today, it would be like a clear kind of moonshine-looking stuff that they would drink and use in all the kinds of ways they were using rum earlier. So that is kind of the birth of American whiskey. George Washington himself was a very productive distiller at Mount Vernon, the largest commercial distiller in his time. And so we love sort of the fact that we're bringing back a spirit, rye whiskey, that was so important in the early days and then nearly almost completely forgotten about after Prohibition.
Yeah. Now, Prohibition was kind of a bump in the fairly serious bump in the road.
A big bump. 13 years. I mean, can you imagine being in business and having that business be illegal for 13 years? It's a miracle anything survived.
And then, of course, and we always celebrate, not celebrate, but we remember and carry on about the great, in Pennsylvania I'm talking about, the Great Whiskey Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was another big historical incident, right?
Absolutely. And all those gentlemen out on their farms making whiskey were making rye whiskey, you know, the famous Monongahela rye. That was kind of interesting, sort of. Also, you know, George Washington had involvement with that as well, going out there to quell the whiskey rebellion.
Right.
So he was very, very interesting piece of our history.
He was trying to shut it down so he could sell more of his hooch.
I won't even go there. Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
Now, what is it about your this? Whatever won the double gold, this particular
round.
Yeah. What is it that was so special about it, do you think?
Well, I mean, we really try to stick to traditional methods and the highest quality ingredients that we can. So, for instance, the grain that we use is organic grain. We don't use organic grain. You know, people will sometimes ask us, well, is it organic? Does that mean it's healthy? And I'm like, no, it's not healthy. It's whiskey. But the grain is clean as can be. It's never seen pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. So it produces a really clean, nice flavor. And it's also from, you know, trying to reproduce a historic grain, it's a more historically accurate grain. So, you know, it's something more akin to what they would have had back in the 1800s when they didn't have Roundup and all these different sprays. So we like it from that perspective. So that's the starting point of the process. And then our distilling and fermenting and mashing processes are all very traditional. So, for instance, in fermenting, we don't have, you know, jacketed glycol chilled fermenters that get the maximum efficiency of alcohol production. You know, we're producing in a big drum like you would have had in a barn in the 1800s at room temperature, subject to the whims of the season. And that produces less alcohol, but a more authentic flavor, a more authentic type of spirit. So really, we adhere to that. And then, you know, the output, the result is the whiskey, you know, which we age in Minnesota white oak barrels. And, you know, each one is tasted before it comes out of the barrel to make sure it's just exactly the flavor we want. So it's just a lot of care and attention that goes into the whole process and produces this beautiful roundstone rye at cask proof. Even though it's about 58% to 60% alcohol, it's just ridiculously smooth.
Yes,
and sweet and drinkable and so full. You know, there's no water added to it when it comes out of the barrel, so you've got the concentrated essence of whiskey in there, really rich color and delicious flavor. So it is really quite nice.
Now, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I was a government contractor. I was a computer engineer for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And 20 years of computers taught me a great love of drinking. As I was approaching my 40s, I was having a bit of a midlife crisis and picturing myself sitting in a windowless cubicle for the rest of my life, typing out PowerPoint charts that people would never even read. And I figured there's got to be more to life than this. And so I kind of had that idea to come and build a whiskey distillery and took that idea to my wife, who is a chemical engineer.
Oh, okay.
And so and she was looking to get back into industry after being out with her with our kids for a while. And I said to her, well, we should make a distillery. You'd be great at it. And she very confidently said, well, I know I can make whiskey. I'm a chemical engineer. You know, that's a process. I can learn how to do it. But she said her challenge to me was, you need to make sure that we can make money making whiskey.
Yes.
And so her challenge was, you know, write a business plan and see if this is viable. Because essentially my business proposition to her was, let's liquidate every bit of money we've saved for the past 20 years and put it into this crazy business. And so she wanted something a little more secure than that. So I wrote the business plan and took it to the bank. And I think, you know, at the time, she would probably say that she pretty much assumed the bank would say no, and then she would have been the supportive wife and, you know, well, it was good you tried, hon, but let's go back to work and just get on with our lives. And the real curveball was that the bank said yes.
Uh-huh.
The bank said, this looks good. We couldn't believe it because we had no experience. It was just a plan on paper. I'd never done it before. And the bank said yes. And this was in 2009 when the stock market was collapsing. The too big to fail thing was happening. You know, banks were going under.
This is crazy, you know. It's totally crazy.
Yeah, it was an absolute miracle. So, you know, in some ways we felt predestined to make whiskey, you know, we had to do it. And so we did. We started buying equipment and the business got launched.
Yeah, hold on a second. You said that you use Wisconsin white oak?
Minnesota white oak. That's correct.
Now, was that something that was traditional or I think of bourbon. I mean, not bourbon, you not only use American oak barrels, but you also only, you char them, and then you only use them once.
Yeah, and that's the same. That's by law in America. The U.S. Federal laws for whiskey require all of us to use one barrel one time, and that's simply written into the laws. So, you know, Jack Daniels has to do the same thing that we do, which is find other users for our whiskey, or for our barrels. Most of our barrels will go to beer houses, breweries, where they will use them for barrel-aged beers. But you know, apart from that, barrels are, you know, from Minnesota, and we've chose those particular barrels because they taste really amazing. You know, the wood is sort of that secret fourth ingredient in whiskey, and the flavor from the barrel, you know, the whiskey literally dissolves away the inside of the wood inside the barrel to give it color and flavor. And so that was a really important choice as far as making it taste the way it does.
Now, you mentioned, I think, I can't remember whether it was before we started the interview or afterwards, but you said historically the whiskey was all white like moonshine. So you were not, at that time, barrels weren't being used?
Yeah, interestingly enough, in the history of whiskey making in the country, when it first started coming out, you know, it was just every farm. You know, it was a way of preserving your crops. You wouldn't have to worry about fungus, mice, or anything like that. You could make it into liquid money, essentially. And so you'd get, you know, this clear spirit, and, you know, they called it whiskey. They called a lot of things whiskey back then, actually. It was sort of a synonym for any kinds of spirits. So they would sometimes talk about apple whiskey, which we would today call apple brandy or Applejack or something like that. But, you know, that term, whiskey, it just meant kind of white spirit, and most of it was rye. And then as they started to make more and more of it, and distilling went more from the homestead and the farmstead to kind of a commercial operation, they really started to increase volume of production and started to have places to put it. And so the storage vessel of the time was a barrel. I mean, they used barrels for everything. They didn't have stainless steel tanks. They didn't have glass. It was too expensive. So for the most part, everybody used barrels, and they used them for fish. They used them for salt pork and for, you know, beef and pickles and you name it, wine and Madeira. And so if they had barrels, barrels were pretty expensive, and you know, you didn't want to just use them and throw them away, so they would reuse the barrels. But if you used a barrel twice, and it had previously contained, for instance, anchovies,
You put whiskey in it. Yeah, exactly. That's not going to be too good. Unless you're in Japan. Maybe they would like that there. I've tasted some pretty fishy stuff over there. But,
sneaky.
But so they would basically try to reuse the barrels. They would char them out, and that would burn away all the fishy flavor, and then you could put the whiskey in there. And I'm quite sure that the very first winter that they put some of those barrels away, and they came back to them in the spring, and they pulled the sample, and they're like, hey, now, that's kind of nice. And so that basic production method was written into the law. It's actually against the law to make whiskey differently than that. It goes into a charred new oak barrel every time.
Well, you went beyond used barrels now to new barrels.
That's right. That's right. So the new barrels is now written in the law, and we're not quite sure why that is. People speculate that the lumber lobby had something to do with it in the 1800s.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But it is actually federal regulation that it has to be in a new barrel every single time. And so we are prohibited from using a used barrel unless it's specifically disclaimed on the bottle, and you so rarely see that happen.
Well, I just thought that was—I've always thought that was really crazy. Now, the lumber lobby makes more sense to me than any of the other reasons.
Now, the interesting thing is, I don't know if you follow other states or not, but in Tennessee,
right? That's what I was just thinking about.
There have been two recent attempts by George Dickel, which pretends it's a small distillery, even though it's owned by Diageo or Fortune Brands or somebody like that.
Right.
And they're trying to get the law changed in Tennessee that you can, in fact, recycle barrels. And their argument being that that will allow people who are smaller operators to enter the whiskey business without having to invest all this money in barrels. Now, we suspect that George Dickel probably had something else in mind.
Yeah, I'm sure. we get asked all the time. Every tour that we do at the distillery, we get asked, why is that law there and why don't you change it? And I have a simple answer to that. You know, the big guys who have a lot of political clout, have no interest in changing that law because they've set up their supply chain and all those barrels are going to Scotland for the most part for aging in Scotch.
Yeah.
So they don't need to. If the law changed, they still have to sell barrels to Scotland, and Scotland still needs barrels to buy because they don't have any trees over there. And so that would happen. But in the small guys like us who would love to reuse our barrels and try to, recycle that wood, don't have any political clout at all, It's hard to get anything done through Congress that we have now. So, the whole prospect of it ever changing is really not going to happen. So we do what the rest of the world does, is figure out our customers and find sources for these barrels.
Yeah. I guess, what are they? They're aging cocktails in barrels now,
yep.
too.
Well, yeah, they are.
Negronis particularly, I think.
Now, let's do some basic stuff. You mentioned tours just a second ago. So where is your distillery located?
So we are located on Main Street, right downtown in Percival, Virginia. So Percival, Virginia is a beautiful little small town, about 5,000 people, about an hour west of Washington, D.C., tucked right up against the Blue Ridge Mountains. So we're about 6 minutes from Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, right along the Potomac and the Shenandoah Rivers. So really pretty little area. Nice access into the city, so that's been great for helping us with our business, having access to lots of those bars and restaurants in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But we get to live the perfect life out here with small town feel.
Did you move there when you started this business, or did you live there?
No, actually, we lived here for 20 years, and when we decided to build the distillery, we decided to build it where we live, in our home. So we literally built the distillery half a mile from where we live, that was because I had spent so many years as a government contractor on, commuting to work 90 minutes one way, 90 minutes the other, and it's just a terrible way to live.
Yeah.
Well,
Becky sounds interesting too, by the way, your wife.
No.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Well, now
she's one of the few female distillers in America that actually does the making of the spirit. There's a lot of female proprietors, but Becky actually puts hands on every single bottle that we make, and that's kind of rare, and she has a wonderful palate, which is really why the whiskey tastes so good as it does.
Uh-huh.
Well, now, here's the other good news. If you're in Pennsylvania, which we are, you can now get your rye whiskey in our state stores. And we understand, and this is one for our friends in England from whom we've just returned. We hope this is going to be on sale in England pretty soon.
We hope.
Yeah, we hope. We hope indeed. For Pennsylvania, we have just been approved in the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board system, so PLCB, to sell our whiskey statewide in Pennsylvania. So every state store should have a bottle of Catoctin Creek Roundstone Rye on the shelf, and that's going to just be fantastic for us. So definitely, listeners in Pennsylvania, run out and buy it, because we have to sell enough of it to stay in the state. And then we're hopeful. I've been in working with some distributors in London, and hoping to be in London as well very, very soon.
Well, so, how else do you get your product? I mean, just through any liquor store in any state that allows it, or what?
Yeah, basically. So we're in a handful of states, about 17, now 18 states in the U.S., from Boston down to Savannah, Georgia, Virginia, Maryland, D.C. is big for us. New York City, another big state for us. If you're in New York City, Astor Wine and Spirits is a very well-known liquor store there. Yes. Where you can pick up our stuff. We have on our website a where to buy link.
Okay.
That you can hit, and you can click on your state, and if you are in one of the states we distribute, then you can see that and go to your local store and ask for it. Or if you're in one of the states that we don't distribute to, it has a shopping cart, and you can fill a shopping cart and get bottles shipped to you, provided that it's legal to do so in your state.
Well, Scott, it seems like you have covered all the bases here.
We try to.
Yeah, and you're a delight to talk to, and your product's a delight to drink. And I wish you much success, and Becky as well.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Well, there you have it. I hope you enjoyed today's program on the drinking side, and that you'll explore the world of wines and spirits more than you perhaps already have. And particularly keep an eye on developments here in these United States, which seems to me to really be kind of leading the world right now in new distilleries and new expressions and all that kind of good stuff. So we'll have more to report on this in upcoming programs, I feel sure. But until next week, all we can do
is say bye-bye.
Bye-bye.